Welcome to All Over the Map. Take chances and ask questions.
Open discussion on all topics. The driving force. Get her done. Laughter is medicine for the soul. It's a small world after all.
Trying to pick it up, got it to Larac in front. Larac by himself, he scores! Hat trick, George Larac! Hat trick, George Larac! And they're going wild!
Ever since he got his second goal, every time he goes near the puck, they've been oohing and on, and now they're throwing those chapeaus all over the place as George Larac is being mobbed at the bench, and what a great move he made!
George Larac played 13 seasons for different National Hockey League NHL teams. He was known as The Rock, acting primarily as an enforcer on these teams. His best-selling biography, The Story of the NHL's Unlikeliest Tough Guy, goes well beyond the stereotype of the tough guy. It is the story of a true humanitarian, an engaged citizen not only in his immediate community, but on the global stage as well. The son of Haitian immigrants, George Larac campaigned for World Vision to help with the Haitian relief and the rebuilding of the Grace Children's Hospital in Port-au-Prince. Today he is involved in many charities, an animal rights activist, and a spokesperson for PETA, PETA. He became a vegan in 2009 and has ever since contributed to the vegetarian movement in Montreal. A conscientious environmentalist, George Larac stepped up in July 2010 to be the deputy leader of the Green Party. Since his retirement, George has been very active as a public speaker. He has been invited to hundreds of events across North America. He captivates and inspires his public by addressing current topics such as sports, motivation, racism, bullying, veganism, politics, and charities. So in total, George Larac played 13 years in the NHL, 695 games including 57 in the playoffs. He made two appearances in the Stanley Cup Final, one with Pittsburgh in 2008 and another with Edmonton in 2006. He also scored one hat trick, which George looks back on his hockey career and he says, "All of this went well beyond my expectations and I'm proud of what I've accomplished. Montreal was my fourth team and I was only traded once at my own request. Every time I became a free agent, I had a dozen teams to choose from. Believe me, when you retire, these are the things that you never forget." All right, the story of the NHL's unlikeliest tough guy, George Larac. Welcome to All Over the Map, George.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a very, very serious question. All right, so who do you think would win in an arm wrestling match between you, the hockey Rock, and the other Rock, Dwayne Johnson?
The other Rock would win easy. You would win easy. It's not the same discipline that we're having. You know, like the way that he trains and the way that I train in hockey is totally different. His arms is twice the size of mine, if you could believe it or not. So he would win by far.
Yeah, I think, he trains fairly hard up at four and he just gives her. Yeah. So anyways, what was it like growing up in Montreal? I lived there for a year and I loved it.
Well, you know, just like every kid, when you're born in Montreal, playing hockey is a dream. So we all want to be in the NHL. So yeah. when I grew up and I was born there, but actually my parents were born in Haiti, but they came to Montreal when they were 20 years old. So when I told them I was going to play in the NHL, for them, they knew nothing about hockey. They didn't even like the winter. So, but me, like all the other kids, I wanted to play. The only thing, though, that I didn't realize that the fact that, you know, being black, wanted to play hockey was known as a white man's sport. I would have to endure a lot of racism to play a sport that I loved.
Absolutely. Yeah, that must have been quite challenging at times. You probably took a lot of, shots vocally hit the emotions, eh?
Well, you know, everybody was calling me the N-word. And the thing is, my parents, they didn't want me to play. So they weren't coming to the rink anymore. So I was on my own. So I had parents from the other team shouting stuff at me, kids from the other teams. It was nonstop. And my parents weren't there in the stands to defend me. And the thing is, they wanted me to stop. So they thought that if they didn't come and watch me play, and with all the insult that I was getting, I would eventually quit.
Yeah.
But I never did. I never did because I told them that if I quit, they're going to win. So I just pursued it. And the only way I could prove people wrong is by making it to the NHL.
You're giving me goosebumps because it's that never give up attitude. I always say, you know, just don't give up, keep pushing forward, you know, and just, you know, ignore the naysayers, you know, and just, so I'm really proud of you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
I actually was going to say, you know, your parents are from Haiti. What was it? That must have been a huge transition for them to come over to Canada from Haiti and get used to the Canadian lifestyle, North American lifestyle, so to speak.
Well, that wasn't a time in a Duvalier time where it was dangerous to kind of be living in Haiti if you had dreams. Yeah. And they wanted to ensure a really good future for their kids. So that's why they decided to move there. And that was at the time when Canada, they were hiring a lot of immigrants for work because there wasn't enough. And then they figured that, you know, if they do a great program to get more immigrants, then it was going to make a difference. So that's why they got to come here, and they were, and a lot of other minorities got sponsored to come to Canada to work. So by coming here, they knew that, you know, it would be safer because they also sponsored all their brother and sister, and for their kids to raise a family would be safer and much better.
That's great. Yeah. So when did you know that you wanted to hockey as a career? And I remember watching you a lot of games and you had a lot of talent for such a big guy. And I always thought that you deserved a lot more ice time. yeah, man.
Well, you know, ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be in the NHL. And it's funny because often people are like, George, when did you knew? Because people usually they say when they're teens at 16 or 17. But I told him I knew when I was seven. Yeah. When I was seven, I knew I was going to go there. It's crazy because when I got older and, you know, when I talk about the secret, the power of the mind and everything, yes. I was doing that at 7 years old and I didn't even know about it.
The law of
vibration. At 7 years old. Yes. I was so in tune as a kid that all my energy was going towards it. So all my decision was that it was towards it. Everything I did as a kid, when I ran, When I ran at the track at the school track and field, anything that I did, it was in a function of me playing in the NHL. So I would always do everything the hardest. I would always train the hardest because my goal was to be in the NHL. So, you know, when you talk about law of attraction, like when you have a goal and you do everything towards it, without even knowing it, from that time I became really competitive. It's because I knew that every time that I would push myself to the to the hardest, I would mostly bring myself towards my goal more and more, other than being lazy, other than you know, not making sacrifices. And I did that for so long that it just became a habit.
Absolutely.
And even today, the only bad thing about that is that I can't do any sport for fun. I'm so used to do everything competitive ever since I was a kid, that even if I play for fun with adults, like with kids, it's different, but with adults, and I'm so competitive that, I have to win.
Yeah, it's funny. The law of vibration is amazing. I've been, you know, unconsciously until like, say, The Secret came out, and I've worked with a lot of those people as well. You know, whatever we think about, we bring about. Whatever we focus on expands. And, you know, literally our brain is like a broadcasting and receiving station for the vibration of thought, you know, so... you know, so many people are becoming more aware these days, you know, having their spiritual awakenings and whatnot, but, you know, this, it's always working. We're always attracting, we're always vibrating at a certain frequency. And, you know, I just love seeing that smile on your face. Cause I think we're obviously in tune with the same thing right now and we both get it. So that's kind of a cool thing, man.
Yeah.
Thank you. So, was it like you, like, what was it like having that tough guy label? And, you know, was that kind of like just accepted along the way? I mean.
Well, the thing is, I didn't like it. I never liked fighting. I did it because it was my job. Yeah. And that's what I had to do to be in the NHL and to stay there. But it was not inside of me. It's just that it's crazy. Because if you got to know me as a person, you'd be like, oh, there's no way this guy is a fighter. There's no way this guy fights for a living, because you'd be like, what? But no, it just that's what I have to do. And I figured, you know, if I have to do this, I might as well be the best at it, because if I'm the best at it, then I don't have to do it as much because people will be afraid of you. But in terms of fighting itself, you know, like I never talk about it unless people ask me questions, but I was never proud of it because, you know, it's dangerous. And, you know, but, you know, it's part of hockey with my size. I knew I had to do that, but it's not something that I was fun. And, you know, a lot of anxiety with this job. And I feel really lucky and fortunate that now that I'm retired, I'm healthy, I'm good. Yeah. Because some of my brothers that did the same job weren't so lucky when they had to retire.
100%. Yeah, I know. I've had 7 diagnosed concussions myself through hockey.
How?
Hockey.
Hockey?
Yeah.
Wow.
Actually, my draft year, I was rated pretty high in the 3rd round. And I got hit from behind really bad into the boards. I broke my shoulder in 3 places and my collarbone and suffered really my first diagnosed concussion. And then it just kind of perpetuated. And that led into some, you know, destructive behavioral patterns. And I still struggle with it. I do, you know, acupuncture, everything I can to actually benefit my mental health. So like my empathy goes out to anybody that's ever, you know, suffered a concussion. You know,
man,
to know what that
7, wow.
I wasn't like you, so big. I was, yeah. I left home at, you know, I just turned 16 and kind of like thrown out to the wolves. I was maybe a buck 50 playing with, you know, most of the guys were, you know, 18, you know, 17, 18 up to 20, whatever. And so it was a bit of a tough go, but you know, you move through the adversity and use that as motivation later in life. Right. So
exactly.
So let's talk health. I heard you went vegan in 2009.
Yes, I did. It's crazy because before 2009, I was the biggest meat eater in the world. Like I used to eat pretty much a cow a day and, you know, and I was eating meat breakfast, lunch and dinner. And then in 2009, a friend of mine was telling me for a long time, you got to watch Earthlings. You got to watch Earthlings with the Joaquin Phoenix narration. And I was like, why? She's like, you're going to see what you're eating, why it's bad for you, bad for animals. I said, I don't care about your documentary. It's annoying. I don't need to know. It's fine. Everything is good. She was asking me for months to watch it. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch it. So she leaves me alone. She's going to stop asking me to watch it. And then she'll just ask me and I'll say, yes, I watched it. And then leave me alone, right? So I watched Earthlings, an hour and a half documentary, and it changed my life. I cried when I watched it. And I was going through so much emotion. And I couldn't believe, I felt like an hypocrite. I couldn't believe how much suffering I made animal endured, how bad it was for my health, for environment. And I was like, that's it. After I saw that, I was appalled about all the industry. I was like, that's it. I'm vegan. I'm becoming vegan. I'm going to die. I'm done. I'm going to miss nutrients, but I don't care. I'd rather die than having anything else. Because I don't know anything about veganism. I'm like, that's it. I'm going to be skinny because I still had another year in the NHL. I was like, I'm done. My life is done, but I don't care. I didn't care.
Yeah.
So I called a nutritionist. I'm like, okay, so my life is done. I'm becoming vegan. I don't know what to do. So she was so happy because she's like, if this guy sticks to it, a hockey player is the best thing for the movement. She came over to my place and we looked at all the stuff that had animal product in it. And I give everything to a shelter because everything had animal product in it. So I had nothing left to eat at home. So we went to a grocery store and then I did my first vegan groceries and I bought stuff like kale. I had no idea what kale was. I was like, that's a salad? Like bok choy. Stuff that I've never even seen before. And I was like, what are those vegetables? We spent 5 hours in a grocery store. She told me about all the stuff to get my iron, to get the nutrients that I needed through all the vegetables and all the stuff that I needed. And it took a while to fully learn everything about the food. So in the beginning, I had a vegan catering that was making me stuff. And with time, I got to learn so much of it that I started doing conferences. Like I started doing talk about veganism all around the world. Yeah. I started talking about it. I started talking about it so much that Sean Monson that made Earthlings with Joaquin Phoenix, he came to Montreal and I did the French narration of it. So you can watch Earthlings on YouTube, but it's called Terrien. You put my name on, you see the same thing, but in French with my voice. So, and now I talk about vegan, like veganism all over the place and inspire people to be vegan and help them with their health and everything. It's crazy from where I was before to where I am now.
Well, it just raises your energetic frequencies. And it's like, it's common sense. Like, why would you put something that's dead, that will take away life from your body.
Exactly. Put
something that's alive into your body that's going to give you life. You know,
yeah.
You are what you eat. You know, we've been hearing that for our whole lives.
You're vegan too? Are you vegan too?
I am now. Yeah.
Awesome.
My body was just not responding to like anything. Like, you know, do I love pizza? Yeah. But I mean, is it get anything gluten? It just doesn't. I have such a sensitive system, man, that it just, you know, I'm very cognizant to what I put in my body.
Actually, I cut out gluten too. Gluten and 100% vegan and gluten free also.
Yeah. And I even cut alcohol out of my life completely.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really rarely I take it because pretty much all alcohol end up vegan anyway. And the one that is doesn't taste that good. So I rarely have a glass or, and don't need it. We're full of energy now. We don't need anything. It's like, always life of a party, always laughing around. I don't need the buzz to be life of a party. It's so easy.
Yeah. You get the good energy that you don't even need it. Yeah. You're already high on life. So you gotta be high on life and high on something that's like,
Exactly. How many people need to be high on something to have fun? That's wrong. If your life is there, it's sad.
100%. So let's hear about meeting the Dalai Lama and what was his energy like? He's had a very interesting life.
You know, it's awesome that you bring this up because I remember this thing like it was yesterday. So, you know, I do a lot of charity stuff. I've done charity stuff all over my career, all the time. I was known for that. All the teams that I've played on, to me, it was very important. Because I'm a spiritual person, and I believe that if I play in the NHL, it was not to beat up people. It's to give me a platform to help others. And I've always felt thankful to God to give me the chance to be playing in the NHL, so I've always felt that I had to give back. So I did tons of charity work. So when the Dalai Lama came to Montreal, the Tibet Association called me and did like, hey, George, we're the Tibet Association, and the Dalai Lama's coming to Montreal. And we'd like to know if you want to host the Dalai Lama. So I hang up, hang up the phone. I was like, okay, stupid prank joke, whatever, right? So they call back. It's like, yeah, George, the line cut. We just called you and we don't know what happened. And I was like, is this a joke? They're like, no, it's not a joke. And I'm like, what? Okay, so say that again. So they're like, yeah, we represented Dalai Lama, and they tell me this, and I'm like, why me? And they said, well, George, we've been following you, and with all the charity works that you do in Canada, we feel that you wanted the most qualified person to do it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that was really deep what they said. And they said, I still thought it was a joke, so I said, could we meet up? So when I meet up in her office, Montreal, I was like, oh my God. This is crazy because I'm going to be on the stage with Dalai Lama talking French and English in the TEDx stadium. And he's going to be sitting beside me and I'll be hosting the whole thing. So I'm in a stage, he's sitting beside me, like pretty much playing with my hair because he's a very touchy guy. He's touching me and stuff. And I'm like, okay, George, it's not the Dalai Lama doing that. Just focus, talk to people. You got a job to do, but he's right there. And sometimes he's touching my hair. And it's like, I was like, you know, it's, you got to keep, stay concentrated. Right. And there's like 20 armed bodyguard around us because it's, you need high security for that because guys like that, you know, they're a big threat because you never know if there's a crazy that wants to make a name for himself and shoot at him or whatever. Right. There's bodyguards everywhere. There's people in the crowds everywhere. And I'm talking French and English about this whole spiritual thing. He's sitting there and I'm hosting it for 2 hours. And at the end, he put the scars around me. It was one of the most touching thing I've ever lived and that's I've beautiful. Ever been privileged of. That was more beautiful than my 13 years in the NHL.
Absolutely.
And then he left. And when he left, the craziest thing happened. When, you know, I don't need the security when I leave. He did, but not me. So I go down the step, go to my car, and the people in the crowds, they were touching me and they were crying because they were touching me everywhere that he touched me to feel him.
Yeah.
So I couldn't leave. So I needed security to go to my car because people were like, oh my God, he touched you there. So they were like, I was swarmed. That's how impactful this person was. And yeah, it's a moment that I will never forget.
Yeah. Spiritual beings having a human experience.
Yeah.
I've been over to Southeast Asia on many, I've been over there 33 times now.
Oh, wow.
I've done a lot of advocacy with human trafficking and child sex slavery. Oh. Rode my bike across Cambodia 3 times and, you know, been into brothels and, you know, yanked kids over on my shoulder out of those brothels and whatnot.
Wasn't that dangerous for you to do that?
Yeah. Absolutely, but I
did. Did he get shot at, or did he get attacked?
I almost got attacked, but I was lucky enough to have part of the organization was actually around me, and I was just like, to mistreat any child for was just to me is brutal. But I know,
good on you for doing that, saving those child. Good on you.
You know, this is the first time I've actually said that I've actually done that, you know, actually talking about it, you know, my TED Talks on that journey, is up on YouTube, whatever, you know, this isn't about me, this is about you,
but this is inspiring what you've done. Like, don't diminish it. That's amazing.
I appreciate it.
You give another chance to this life, for life to those child. So that's very good.
Well, this is the first time in a long time. I mean, I literally have non-physical energy feels like it's just rippling through my body. I got goosebumps.
Yeah.
Because I've actually been very blessed where most of those monks over in those countries, they won't talk to any person. They won't even touch another person unless they're a monk or whatever. And I've actually been really blessed to be, over 50 monasteries I've been into, and just, it's been a total blessing. I know that the first time I rode across Cambodia, just being swarmed by these monks, and I went, I think you're a reincarnated old monk. And I was like, I don't know, but it's just, feel good around those kind of people, because there's always no ill intentions, you know, they're just at peace with their mind, and they're not searching for anything outside themselves. You know, it's just, you know, they're always performing acts of selflessness and compassion and kindness, which I believe is what the world needs right now, especially in these times.
Yes. Yeah. 100% agree with you. That's amazing. You're an amazing soul.
And so are you, my friend. That's why I'm so blessed to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, and then you squared off with George St. Pierre. Let's talk about that one.
Yeah, well, he's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And what happened is that when George became known in the UFC, the thing is, he lives in Montreal. And everywhere he goes in Montreal, and that was years ago, not anymore, but years ago, people, they didn't pay that much attention to him because he didn't play for the Canadiens. The Canadiens is the biggest attraction in Montreal. And, you know, hockey players are everything, and he's one of the best in the world, and people didn't pay him attention. So the USC decided to do one of his card in Montreal. So before doing it, the promoter had an idea that maybe doing an exhibition match between me and him. And if he did that, because if George St. Pierre, even though he's a world champion, if he beats an NHL heavyweight, then he's the best in the world, especially if he beats a Montreal Canadian. So when he asked me to do that, I knew I wouldn't stand a chance. But I knew to promoting the next card that was going to be Montreal and Bell Center, the next UFC card that he was going to fight in it, I knew it'd be good for them. So they're like, we'll give you tickets, you know, And I said, no problem. I knew George, so I knew I wasn't going to get hurt. So we did this exhibition match in the octagon, and I had no chance. I knew I had no chance, but we played it along on TSN, and we kind of wrestled for fun. And it'd be pretty much like me fighting with a towel. Like, he ragdolled me. He did whatever he wanted with me. If he wanted me to suck my thumb, I probably would have done it. If he wanted to put a diaper on me, he probably could have done it too. I couldn't do anything. He had full control of me and stuff. So, and it's crazy because after that happened, that's when they realized that he was good. Not because he had a belt, because he kind of did whatever he wanted with me. And I was known as the heavyweight champion in NHL, right?
Right.
So then it was quite ironic that how the perception of people in Montreal changed after that.
And you guys were buddies squaring off at it too, eh? So.
Yeah. Well, no, we're friends, but we weren't hitting. It was more like doing takedowns. There was no hitting in the face and stuff like that, but no takedown. But George did say that if he came in my element on the ice and we fought, he knew, he'd say the same thing. Same thing happened to me on the octagon would happen to him on the ice. He wouldn't stand a chance on the ice because, you know, it's, that's what I did for a living. And what he does for a living is to fight in the octagon, right?
His balance is a little different.
Yeah, everything is, yeah.
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 All right. So, yeah, I saw you. You're on season two with CBC's Battle of the Blades.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Well, you know, when they ask us to do this, you know, my bucket list, there's so many things in it. And I'm like, okay, well, figure skating, why not, right? So I decided to do it. And because I love winter sports, I was born in December. I love the cold. I love winter sports. So I love challenges. So I decided to try it. And I did. And it's crazy because I got to learn that while I was practicing it, figure skating is harder physically and harder than hockey. All of us, the hockey players that were paired with a girl Olympian, we got hurt more in 6 months of figure skating than some of us our entire career in the NHL. It was insane how demanding, how much it hurt. Even me, I almost lost my eyes. I got 12 stitches there. I almost got skates in my face. I could have lost my eye. I got so many stitches while I did this show. But the thing that I loved the most about it is after the show was done, you know, I always want to do things for a reason. There was guys that, there's lots of guys in the world that get intimidated because they do figure skaters. Because, you know, guys are saying, you know, if they're real men, they should be playing hockey. There's even parents that are wondering if it's okay if their sons are doing figure skating because, you know, how their son is going to be perceived. There's a bad stereotype that goes with figure skating.
Yeah.
So what I decided to do, since I learned in Battle of the Blades, I learned the basic of figure skating. So I started doing an intimidation campaign towards people that were intimidating boys doing figure skating. So what I did is shows starting to invite me to do the year-end shows. All the rinks, they have year-end shows for figure skating. And I started doing year-end shows in pretty much all the clubs around Montreal and in Canada. And I did the shows for free. And that was my contribution to fight against, you know, intimidation. So when I started doing that, I started relaying the message to everyone that figure skating is harder physically and mentally than hockey. And more people were listening to the message. And I was talking to parents that said, is that okay if my son does figure skating? And that was my part that I did. I was able to create a campaign just to sensibilize people because you had the NHL heavyweight doing figure skating saying that it's harder. So nobody can debate with me because I fought for a living. So if I say figure skating is harder physically and mentally, I would know what I'm talking about because I did one of the hardest jobs in professional sport. So that's why I'm glad that the experience that I had in Battle of the Blade permit me to be able to do something much more important. And hopefully a lot of kids felt safer about practicing the sport that they love without thinking that how people are going to think of me, what people are going to say. So that's why to me it was so important.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I grew up with Paul Kariya in North Vancouver, and his mom got him into figure skating when he was like 5 or 6. And he wasn't a bad skater.
Yeah, no, he was an amazing skater.
He could fly up there. Oh my God.
Yeah, he was amazing.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, social activism, which we have talked about, social activism has been a big part of your life. Can you tell me about giving back to your roots in Haiti? And what other charities have you been involved with?
Okay, so in Haiti, what happened is, as I told you earlier, my parents were born there. So when the earthquake happened in Haiti, you know, I felt like devastated because there's tons of Haitian people that live in Montreal. My parents are from Haiti, right? And I'm like, and I was playing hockey at the time with the Montreal Canadiens. So I'm like, okay, so when I have to do something, what can I do to help out? How can I do to make a difference? Because my origins are from there. And again, when you talk about everything happens for a reason, I got released by the Montreal Canadiens February 21st, 2010. That was a couple of weeks after the earthquake that happened. You know, I was hurt a lot when I was in Montreal. I tuned the disc and then I wasn't playing that much. So when I got released right away, I joined force with the NHL. The NHLPA raised millions to help rebuild the Grace Children's Hospital that crashed during the earthquake. And I went back to Haiti 4 times after the earthquake. I went back there with some NHL players to bring awareness to the hospital, to bring awareness to what was going on in Haiti. And that was part of me, like, because that's where I was from. So I decided to do that. And I'm still today an ambassador for World Vision to be able to help out charities to try to make a difference in the society. And that's why, you know, when you think again, when a tragedy happens often, it's because, you know, the world needs you somewhere. They need you to make a difference somewhere, to do something. And to me, that's what it was. And that's why I decided to do that. But, you know, when you ask me in terms of what are the charities that I've done, I've done tons. Every time somebody needed help or something, you know, something that was charitable to me, it was so important to donate times and to be there to help out. Because as I said earlier, I'm so thankful that I have a career in the NHL that you know, I'm obligated to give back because God gave me this platform and not to be the richest guy in the cemetery when I die. No, to teach by example kids that one day might have the same success as I have and wanna transmit the same message to the world, to the society, when you have a platform to make a difference, you know?
Absolutely. I know one of the people that I looked up to the most, you know, growing up, even though he was a lot older, was Muhammad Ali. And, you know, I think one of his famous quotes was, you know, the rent that we pay for, you know, being on earth is service. And I know I've dedicated, you know, the back end of my life is dedicated to world service. So we're definitely on the same page with that one. So it seems like you always have a smile on your face. Is there anything that you haven't done? Let's hear about your book, bro.
Well, you know, like, the reason why I did my book and I decided to write it is when I was a kid and I was talking to you about the racism that I was facing. Again, all my energy was towards be playing the NHL, and that was my role. That was my goal. And that's what I had to do. So what happened is that, you know, I was alone and, you know, my parents weren't supporting me and they weren't with me and nobody was there. And when you talk about the law of attraction again, life gave me something on a platter. And it was the kid's version of Jackie Robinson's autobiography. Yeah. When I read that, I was like, oh my God, this is it. Jackie Robinson's autobiography as a kid, when I read it, I saw that him too, he had to face racism to become the first black player to play baseball.
Yep.
And when I read it, it gave me the energy to face racism like he did, to use it as motivation, like energy to make it to the NHL. So what I did after I read that book, it was easier. When I got all the stuff that I got after, I channeled it in energy in the sport that I was doing. So when my dream was to be playing the NHL when I was a kid, I had a second one and to write my own autobiography like Jack Robinson did. Because if his book did that to me and gave me the energy to be playing the NHL, I knew my book could do the same to many minorities that want to pursue and I want to make it to anything, not just in hockey, but anything they want to accomplish in life. And I knew with my book, I can inspire them. So that's why I wanted to do my book, is to do like him, to follow his footsteps. And because it shows you how powerful a book could be, an inspiration, how much inspiration you could get from a book when you're struggling for so many reasons, right? And I became a public speaker after I wrote the book. But the thing is, this story that I have to tell is so different than all the other guys that, you know, most guys that talk about, I made it professionally, they talk about the support of the parents and this and that, right?
Yeah.
A kid that is teaching his parents a lesson to make it professionally is something completely different. Because I'm not talking when I was a teen and my parents weren't supporting me, when I was a minor. Even my dad, sometimes when he does an interview and he says, you know what? Kudos to my son because he did it on his own. We weren't there. People are like at 7, 8 years old, how did you do that? How do you have the strength to do that? How do you have the strength to face all this racism? And again, you know, strength came from above. I could take some of the credit too, but it came from above that gave me the power to be able to withstand all that and to be the person that I am today.
Absolutely. Just desire, you know, the triggering mechanism and the perseverance, you know, that you put into your, you know, your vibrational set point, so to speak, It's just, I was really attracted to your story. I can't wait to actually get a signed copy of the book. You know, I'll send you a copy of my book too.
but I'll happily send you one.
I'd love to send you one.
Yeah.
I'll probably read it in a night. Yep.
If you have one too, I'll read yours too.
Because I'll send you a copy. That'll be our deal. You send me a book. You send me yours, and I'll send you mine.
Deal. Awesome deal.
Awesome. Deal. I'd punch you over the with a fist pump. There we go. So, what was being on Dragon's Den like?
No, that was not me on Dragon's Den. That was
I was misinformed then.
Yeah, no, Dragon's Den, that was, it's another fighter, another black guy that fought in the NHL. His name is Donald Brashear.
He was on Dragon's Den.
He was on Dragon's Den because he had a hockey stick apparel that he created and stuff. So, it's not a guy.
Did you guys ever go at it?
Yes, many times we have, because he's a French guy too.
Yeah.
We're a big rival when I play in the NHL. And he played over 1,000 games in the NHL. So
yeah,
he was a legend. When you talk about Fisk, he was a legend in the NHL.
He was a nice person. I met him when he was, well, obviously being from Vancouver.
Yeah.
I'd see him out at the Roxy, I don't know, three nights a week back in the day. He'd actually be behind the bar laughing and making drinks for people and stuff like that. Yeah. But I found him to be a really nice person.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's that thing that happened between him when McSorley took that cheap shot on him.
The hockey stick when he got in the head and it concussed him. That was not the.
I mean, his head bounced off the ice like a tennis ball on a buddy tennis court. I was horrified. That was brutal.
Yeah, so, we all were. I'm glad that he came out of it okay. McSorley is very, very lucky that he never pressed charge after he did that. He hit him in the head. In head with a stick.
It was like attempted murder, pretty much. Yeah. That's what it looked like.
Yeah.
I don't mean to like downgrade Mr. McSorley there. I know he's probably a great guy. That was cheap.
It was cheap. It was not good. It was not good.
And luckily we don't see that.
Anymore. If somebody did that today, they'd be banned from the league forever.
For life, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So what do you have planned for the future, my friend?
Well, the thing is, right now, I do so many things now. I'm a public speaker. I'm on the radio. I help out as many people as I can. I have a few businesses that I take care of. But, I never know, though. The thing is that I'm a sport of a moment guy. I never know what's going to happen. I live in the moment, like the present, all the time. I don't anticipate anymore what's going to happen. All my life, I anticipated playing the NHL. My biggest goal, and it happened. But now I have nothing even close to that. Now I live my dream every day, and I help out every day. I try to make a difference every day. I'll try to live my life to the fullest every day now. And try to stay in shape and try to be an example and try to be an example for my kids that live with their mom in Edmonton. And I travel back and forth because I live in Montreal. So, I do so many things, so many projects, and, I try to be positive in society and be an example.
Awesome, man. So if you have any advice for the people that are going through a tough time right now, what can they do to motivate themselves?
Well, first thing is, I know with what's going on right now with the crisis.
And you had COVID, right?
Yeah. Yes, I did. I did. And it wasn't that big of a deal when I got it. I knew I was going. The thing is that everything depends on your perception. Some people got COVID and they're so afraid of it because of what they're seeing in the media. Then when you get it, it hits you harder because you panic while you're sick. Me, I'm always smiling. When I got it, I was like, I was in a room in the hospital. I was doing push-up. I was moving around. People were looking at me like it was crazy. I was acting like I wasn't sick. When you're moving and stuff, disease cannot live in a healthy body, in a body that you want to move. If you sleep and you don't do anything all day long, it's going to take longer to recuperate. When you're active, the virus wants to come out. So it just, everything in life, whether it's COVID or anything else, you're having a tough time. The only way you're going to come out of it is with positive attitude. Because negative always slows you down, even in a tough time. Yeah. It's always easier to find solution once you like take a time to reflect. And after that, you think positive and you change that energy. Yep. Because with negative energy, we don't go forward, we go backwards. And it's the first thing that you have to learn when you're going through a tough time. Realize that doesn't matter how tough at the time you're going through, you are lucky that in North America, you have a chance to achieve your dreams.
Absolutely.
Because often there's people like in other parts of the world that when you go and visit there, they ask you for a job. They ask you for anything because they have nothing. In North America, we have everything, all the chance to achieve a dream. If we work hard, you know, and you can look in the papers, find a job. You could always do what you want, but it all depends on the energy you put towards it.
Absolutely.
And
focusing,
if you play the
victim.
Exactly. Because often people, they play the victim and they think that life should give you something on a platter, but life is not like that. You have to work for it.
Absolutely.
And when you work towards something, you're going to achieve something. Life always rewards the people that work the hardest. It's just that sometimes people don't work. They forget how to work, or something bad happened and they quit on everything. But if you quit on everything, nothing can happen. And me, I just often, when I talk about my story, about how my parents come to Montreal when I'm 20 years old, right? The odds of me playing in the NHL were 0.001%. On top of that, my parents didn't want me to play. When my parents told me they didn't want to play, did I say, I can't play in NHL, my parents don't want me to play, I'm done. If I would have said that 10 years later, I would have regretted. I was like, I should have kept going. There's so many people that, not just in sport, but in anything else, they're like, 6 years ago, I was living my dream, and because of my girlfriend, because of my parents, because of my friend that didn't believe me, because of this, you always have reason. But the only person responsible of your success is yourself. So if you look at my story, what I've done, I didn't care that people didn't believe in me and whatever I was doing. I did. That I control my own destiny.
Absolutely.
Well, you also control your own destiny. You're traveling through a tough time right now. Well, I know that a lot of people are. But you know what? You could come out of it. You're in control of it. And to be in control of it, you have to now, you know, look at all the negative it did and turn it to a positive. Like, take it as, okay, I'm going to go through this. It's a process that we're all going through, but I'm going to come out of it. Just say, yeah, I'm going to come out of it. I know I'm going to come out of it.
Yep.
Say it a few times. Look at stuff in the mirror. Believe it. Say it. And then all of a sudden, the energy is going to change. And then it's going to be easy to do something else, to achieve, to do something. Because if you're bad on yourself and you put your hands down, you start drinking and you're sitting on the couch, you're not moving and calling everybody, you're just bitching. All this time is time that you're wasting to find the solution.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's been proven over and over again. You can't be on a negative vibration and a positive vibration at the same time. It's impossible.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an inside job. At the end of the day, it's like, you know, self-help and all that kind of stuff. You know, the only person that can actually really help you at the end of the day is, first, you have to be willing to help yourself, you know, and then being able to reach out to help others too. And then it's all, you know, the collective consciousness, kind of like attracts like, obviously. And, you know, those people just start popping up into your experience, and you start working with the energy and the frequencies and whatnot. And when you're feeling low, sometimes you have to accept, okay, yeah, I'm feeling low right now. And then I just got to boost that energy up through positive thinking. You know, it's sometimes easier said than done, but, you know, with practice, you know, mindfulness and whatnot, you know, we can get to that space. And it seems like that you're there.
Man, brother, me and you were similar. You know, when you always say that law of attraction, it attracts people that are similar. And the way that I've listened to you from the beginning, we're pretty much the same. You're my brother from another mother, man. We're pretty much
the same person. I was going to say the same thing, but I didn't want to offend you. That's awesome, man. Yeah, maybe we can do some cool things in the future together, man.
Yes.
You know, where
do you live? Where do you live?
I'm in the Okanagan right now, but you know, what I'm doing with the show is you know, obviously, you know, featuring people like you that are just doing good and you know, doing good for humanity. And that's what it's all, you know, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
I think these days, you know, being in the days of drastic change is having people that have the courage and the strength to speak their truth And, you know, and just living in that truth and living in gratitude and, you know, just being grateful that, you know, like if you're breathing today, you're here for a purpose.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Like your job's not done yet here. And, you know, a lot of people that, you know, we suffer in the physical world. Yeah, we do. But we can turn that suffering into joy and fulfillment pretty easy, you know, especially when we're talking to like-minded people such as yourself.
Yeah. Awesome.
So when you first started public speaking, how was that all? How did that work out for you? Were you nervous in the beginning?
I've always loved platforms.
Yeah.
You know, I've always loved to talk. I've always loved to entertain. I've always loved to talk to people. And the thing is, when I wrote my book, everything changed. Because when I retired, like, I was like, okay, my second dream was to write the book, but I didn't know the impact it was going to be.
Right.
I didn't know if people would even care about my story, right? So I did it in French and English and became bestseller in both languages. And I was like, whoa, people do care about the book. And then after people read it, I start getting calls about, would you do a talk about your story? Would you do a talk to this different group? Would you and then it just happened. And I became a public speaker because, you know, and then when I became vegan, then it got even bigger because people were like, okay, how does a big black guy that used to fight in the NHL, play in the NHL, and be vegan? How does he do it? How does he do for protein? How is this so big? How do you fight being, like, all the questions people were wondering. So I started doing more conferences about veganism than more so about motivation. And I was like, if somebody would have told me one day that I would talk more about the fact why I eat carrots than how I made it to the NHL, I would have never believed it. But actually, it's true. Today, I talk more about veganism than actually hockey. Which is fine because, again, it's so important to educate people about the way they eat, for their health and everything. So I understand that and it's fine. And then it's just that with time, then I just, you know, I go to a place, people want me to come and talk. It was like, what do you want me to talk about? And then I just prepare it and here I go.
And it's like 150 conferences you've done now, right? 150
platforms? Yeah, well over that.
I would say too, it's like, you know, what you do and who you are two separate entities. You know, hockey is something that you did for, you know, a certain amount of time, which gave you the blessing, obviously, to put yourself on a platform to be able to do what you're doing now. And then it just expands and, you know, law of attraction, you know, moving through life experience with confidence and faith and just, you know, allowing source to pour in and through you unindated, where it's just like, you know, it gives you that exuberance and that just that shining light. And I can feel it, man. I can feel it, like, just over this. This is definitely one of the most, I'm so grateful. This has been such a great talk, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh no, thank you, brother. Thank you.
So, how can we follow your journey? You know, obviously on Instagram and social media and your book, obviously.
You know, my website, joshuawhite.com, everything's on there on my website because people contact me, for any word of advice or even for having me as a speaker, anything there is. But yeah, I'm big on social media also, cool. My opinion on different things and stuff. And also, I do lots of jokes too, because I think that life is too short.
So, to the soul.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I have lots of energy and sometimes, you know, when I'm bored, want to make something laugh, I might do something funny. And sometimes I talk about more serious subjects. So sometimes I talk about veganism, sometimes about sport, about so many different things. But if you like entertainment, well, you'll love my page.
Watch you.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, it's sure been nice having you on here. And I really look forward to connecting with you, you know, beyond all over the map.
Hey, you know what? Anytime, brother, you want to connect, you have my number, you could call me. And
awesome.
When this crisis thing cools down, and I'm always all over the place, so if I'm close to Akmal again, but I'm pretty sure we'll connect for sure. Connected now, it's for a reason. So I'm sure in the future that we'll connect in person.
Absolutely. I got lots of good friends in Montreal. I can always, you know,
fly there.
And, yeah.
Yes. When you come and then we'll have a vegan dinner and it'll be awesome. Sure.
As long as you're cooking.
Oh, I could. I've owned a vegan restaurant for so long that I can.
Oh, no cool, problem. Man.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's great having you on, George.
Thank you, Ryan.
All right. We'll talk to you soon, brother.
Yes. Thank you, brother.
Take care.
You too.